Okay. Welcome to Seemingly Ordinary. I'm back with Sam. Sam is a senior at Rockhurst University who is going to law school in August. And in the last episode, we talked about his novels, but then we also had a wide-ranging conversation about a wide variety of subjects. And I just encourage you to listen to that episode. He's a highly articulate person who tells just great stories. And so we're going to get into more of that today. This just really surprised me to find out, Sam, that you have an album, maybe two albums.
Yeah, well, I got...
This is so interesting because, okay, the type of person who's writing novels and is interested in philosophy and theology and literature and politics may not necessarily also have albums. So what's going on with that? That's so great. By the way, I listened to several songs on the first album.
Thank you.
And I just really enjoyed it.
Thank you. Yeah, well...
I thought this is really good rock and roll.
It's rock and roll. It's the bones of rock and roll, you know?
What's the name of the album?
It's called Them Who Haunt.
Where do I find it?
Everywhere.
Okay, like Spotify?
Spotify, you know, Apple Music, Pandora, YouTube.
Okay, is it free?
It is free, yeah.
Okay.
Of course. Okay. Well, you got to get it out there.
You know?
And what happened with those albums, you'll notice that it's just me on guitar and harmonica. And what happened with those were not recorded to be on an album. Those were all demos written over a period of probably 3 to 4 years.
Okay.
And, you know, I'm always writing songs. Because yes, constantly, as often as
highly prolific author.
Well,
you have a 700 page novel. Before that, you have another novel that was about 300 pages.
You got to stay moving. You got to keep the engine well maintained.
Yes, you do.
You know, and the thing about songs specifically, I think that mode of artistic expression specifically. Comes from a different place. I think with a lot of novels that you might write, you think, yeah, that's me and that's my experience and this is what I'm writing about. But with a lot of songs, you know, if you write a lot of songs, then you're bound to have one or two that you think stick and are good, you know. So every once in a while I'll get a good song. And
How do you think that works? Like, you have to write 10 songs to get one good song?
Probably for me, it's like 1 in 20, I would say.
But how many songs do you think you've written there? Because the album was, what, maybe about 10 songs long?
Yeah, but they're not. They're 11. It's 11 songs, but probably only 3 or 4 of them were good.
Okay.
You know, but I've probably written like 100 songs.
100 songs.
I would say so. Okay. But songs happen very quickly.
Okay.
I think that's the general consensus.
I guess the Beach Boys wrote Fun, Fun, Fun on the way from the hotel to the airport in a car.
Probably.
That's what I've read.
But I would say the studio process took a long time.
Okay.
You know, I don't know if the movie Love and Mercy is accurate or not, but doesn't matter. That's a side thing. But I think songs specifically come from another place.
Okay.
If they're good, you know.
Where do they come from?
There is like a platonic world of forms where these songs have always existed and you're
discovering the songs.
You're discovering the songs. That's what Bob Dylan said about writing songs.
Okay, you're not writing or creating the song. It's coming to you from the other world.
You're discovering it. Okay. It doesn't really belong to you.
Okay.
Bob Dylan said that about Van Morrison's Tupelo Honey. He said that song has existed for 1,000 years.
And
you know, Van is just the earthly vessel.
It's a dewdrop from God.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Or something. And that's not to hype up the music on the album. I don't think any of those songs are like that, but I think there's like certain lines or a certain chord change, a little step down in the melody that you're like, huh. I don't think that's mine.
Wow.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do.
You might encounter that when you're writing prose, too.
I do. I feel like I do, just because, just to be a little bit random, I'm writing a novel right now, which maybe I'll call Atlantis.
Yeah.
It's about this very, very rich guy who's in competition with this other rich guy who one of the rich guys maybe wants to provoke World War III and the other one would like to stop him from doing so. But I have four characters that he's enlisting so that he can, accomplish a positive mission. And one of them is a lady who is a doctor in a hospital, about 30. She's a resident and her husband was killed in a car wreck and she is grief-stricken. And she is, at the same time, she's an excellent doctor, top grades, thinks for herself, just really puts the patients first, and is just really kind of an ideal doctor.
Yeah.
And came from a family of doctors, so she comes by it naturally. She's been immersed in the medical world. It's all she's ever really known since she was, 2 years old.
Hmm.
Well, but at the same time now, she's dealing with this overwhelming grief, and she has these two young children. But then at the hospital, they present her with an ethical situation, and she decides to do the right thing, and as a result, she gets fired. And just a little bit later, she ends up getting hired by this billionaire who needs a doctor for this adventure or this mission that they're going to go on.
Yeah.
Well, there's just all types of little things that happen with these characters along the way that are just total surprises. Maybe you have this experience when you're writing your 700-page novel, but
yeah.
I perpetually get surprised by what this character says or what this other character says.
And yeah.
It just feels like you're living in a dream in a way where, you don't know what's going to happen next at all. And things just happen. Things just drift. Like other people write about themselves and their own experience. I actually probably do something like 70 pages worth of pre-writing before I start any novel where I'm doing these long character sketches,
interesting.
And just really trying to understand this person on the inside and the outs, because in many cases they're very different from me.
Yeah.
You know, if you just, for example, looked at them from a Myers-Briggs standpoint, maybe I'm an ENFP, but maybe they're, something else completely different.
Yeah.
And so I'm just really trying to put myself in that other person's shoes.
Right.
As much as possible.
Right.
So I love that. But that just leads to a lot of surprises.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So. Well, yeah, I had a couple of my family members, extended family members object to some of the language that my characters were using in the first novel.
Okay.
And it's like, man, wait till you read the second novel. Some of the coarse language. And one of them came up to me and said, Sam, I really wish you hadn't done that.
Okay.
And you hadn't written all that coarse language. I'm like, I didn't. Well, I wrote it, but it's not mine. These are the characters talking.
Yeah.
You know, it's not.
Yeah.
They're not my mouthpieces,
Right.
It's not.
Right, just because.
It's not a platonic dialogue.
Yeah, it doesn't mean that you're endorsing what the characters say. From very simple terms, if somebody wrote a murder mystery, that doesn't mean you're endorsing murder.
No.
Because you've got it. It doesn't mean Agatha Christie is not endorsing murder.
Yeah.
She writes 86 murder mysteries. People are dying like flies in her books. It doesn't mean she's endorsing that.
Yeah. Well, and I go back to the Gospels, and I think Jesus didn't like to tell parables about good people at all.
Oh, interesting.
You know.
Let me think about that. Well, I mean, aren't there good characters in some of the parables?
There are.
For example, take the prodigal son.
There are, yeah.
Isn't the father basically a good character?
There are, but it's about the narrative arc of the parable.
That's true.
And there's a difference, by the way, between allegory and parable.
Okay.
And I think there's a reason that Jesus spoke in parables, not allegories.
Okay.
You know, because an allegory is where each character or each object in the story represents something larger.
Yes.
You know, like
Plato's cave or something.
Plato's cave, Orwell's Animal Farm.
Okay.
You know, that's an allegory.
We've got this horse and Animal Farm that's a really hard worker, and whatever the problems are, hey, look, it doesn't matter. We just are going to work harder. He's personally going to work harder.
Yeah.
And then they work this damn horse to death and then sell him off to the glue factory.
Yeah.
Which sort of the moral of the story is, okay, you're not going to get out of this jam.
Yeah.
With just hard work.
Yeah. And part of it is Orwell is just telling the story of the Soviet Union.
Right.
But I think Jesus, with the parables, he's making in economics what we might call normative claims about the world instead of a positive claim.
Yeah, normative claim, that's just a factual statement. Is correct?
It's actually counterintuitive. The normative claim is the one that's the kind of positing a theory about how the world ought to be, how it is.
Okay, gotcha.
You know, so you got normative economists and you have positive economists. You have positive economists trying to explain the world as is.
Okay.
You have normative economists trying to propose policies to make it better.
I see.
You know.
Okay.
And so I think about that a lot, and I hope that my writing or your writing or anyone's writing has enough narrative merit such that we can look past the faults of the characters and see the bigger picture.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I think with fiction, nothing should be off limits.
No,
I do feel that if you're going to do something that might appear to be gratuitous from, say, like, I don't know, a point of view of, like, okay, violence or sex or something, then I think those things should serve the plot.
Yeah.
They definitely need to serve the plot. And if they don't, if they're just in there for shock value, then they probably should be taken out. But, you know, I think plot comes first, I think, or plot and character are tied for first.
Yeah, right.
And we're here to show like all types of people. I look at Shakespeare and people said, well, there's one of everybody.
Yeah.
Like you go through like all of Shakespeare's characters and he's got one of everybody.
Yeah.
And I just think that that's absolutely great.
Yeah. And I like seeing darkness in characters, you know, I like seeing the,
well, we have a shadow side.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of the psychologist.
You're a big Jung fan.
I am. I'm a huge Jung fan. And
yeah.
Jung basically says that, okay, so everybody's got an ego and they have a shadow.
Yeah.
And the ego is everything that you're aware of.
Yeah.
You know, your entire life story, your history, your opinions, your feelings, everything that you're aware of that's in your ego.
Uh-huh.
And then all the traits that you have that you don't like are probably getting dumped in your shadow.
Mm.
So, you know, for example, let's say, and there could be positive traits, but there could also be negative traits dumped into the shadow.
Yeah.
So, like, let's say, for example, that I like alcohol a little too much.
Yeah.
You know, I don't, but let's just say for the sake of argument that I do.
Right.
Well, then I could go into denial about that, dump that in the shadow, and then suppress that as much as possible. But the problem is if you don't acknowledge that this exists, then usually that shadow, Jung says it gets blacker and denser.
Yeah.
And then it will pop out at the worst possible moments.
Mm.
You know, so for example, you're at your sister's birthday party. And, you know, you've always been just a little frustrated with your sister on such and such a topic.
Yeah.
Like you love her dearly, but there's this one little topic where it just sort of like rubs you the wrong way.
Right.
Well, if you're not aware of that shadow side of you, that you have the ability to be just a real monster, then chances are you are going to say the worst thing imaginable at the worst time possible.
Right.
When everybody is having a good time, then you're going to pop off with some stupid thing that you're going to wish that you never said in the first place, and you're going to wreck her 21st birthday party.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
But, I mean, if you're aware that, oh, I'm capable of this, then Jung calls that integration.
Mm.
Now you're aware that, oh, yeah, I could be a real piece of crap.
Yeah.
So, like, once you realize what a piece of crap you can be,
yeah,
you're starting to become more integrated.
Yeah, it's the Solzhenitsyn thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now you don't. He's definitely saying you shouldn't act on these shadow things.
No.
Like, if you've got, like, the tendency to, I don't know, say sarcastic, belittling things to people, it doesn't mean you should.
Yeah.
You should just be aware that it exists.
Yeah, yeah. So. And that there's very little, maybe not much, separating you from becoming an evil person.
Right.
You know?
Right. Once you understand just, like, what a piece of garbage you can really be.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's the shadow side.
And that's the...
The people who think they're perfect are probably building up the biggest, densest, most horrible black shadow of them all.
Yeah. And that's why I get instantly frightened of people who feel that they have to be moralistic when it comes to works of fiction.
Yes.
You know?
Well, they're wrecking it.
Yeah.
They're wrecking it.
Because it's like do you not experience enough shame on a daily like
okay,
you know,
keep going with that.
That's well, it's like, well, you and I are both Catholic and
uh-huh.
you don't, I don't think there's been a day for as long as I can remember where I haven't thought to myself, I was raised Catholic, so that's important too, mm-hmm. but where I hadn't felt shame about something.
Yeah.
You know, there's no real.
Yeah. I either did something or I saw something or I felt something or I thought something.
Yeah.
which was not so great.
I don't think I've ever been, I've felt like I was where I was supposed to be for more than a day.
Okay.
You know?
Do you mean like morally and ethically?
Morally and ethically, like I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing.
Okay.
I'm clear. My conscience is clean.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
There's always just something that's bothering you a little bit, and it's about becoming comfortable with that.
Yes.
Sort of.
Yeah.
Tension.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I just wrote a poem about. At Visitation Parish, where we both attend, you know, there's that snake on the handle. Have you ever gone to confession there?
No.
Oh, it's terrifying.
Okay.
Because there's that little room right by the baptismal font.
Okay.
And that's where confessions are held. And the handle to enter is shaped like a snake.
Okay.
It's got a little head and it's looking right at you.
I mean, and then the snake in Catholicism is a symbol of Satan. So we're putting that on the confessional door.
We're putting that on the confessional
door.
See,
this is what's so great about Catholicism. I've heard a few Jungian explainers, like there's an author, Robert Johnson, who would say that just everything about life is in the Catholic Church, because they've got heaven, they've got hell, they've got God, they've got the devil, they've got the light, they've got the dark. It's all present.
Yeah.
You know, now, I mean, if we're going to pretend that the dark doesn't exist, then we're living in fantasy land.
Yeah, yeah. I think...
I mean, look, I'm not a big fan of certain things. Like, for example, I'm just like, I was never that person who read a lot of horror stories, although I read 12 novels by Stephen King, but then it got to be a little bit too much for me, I suppose. And
did you read them like in order of publication?
I probably.
Oh, okay.
Like when things were coming out. But yeah. When I was 16, I read Pet Sematary, and I couldn't read that thing after 10 p.m. because I just was like looking around to the dark corners and just being scared out of my wits.
Yeah.
Silence of the Lambs, the film. I like that film.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's about the only horror movie that I like.
Really?
I consider it to be a horror movie.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I like it. I think the characters are extremely well done.
Yeah.
That's Jodie Foster and Anthony Hopkins.
Right.
He plays a serial killer called Hannibal the Cannibal. And this is ordinarily the type of thing where I would say, let's go see the comedy instead.
Yeah. Okay.
So,
wow.
Yeah. So I'm not like they asked me to teach a World War II class, and I thought, how about not? You know, because it's very much like on the dark side.
Yeah.
Holocaust. You know, I'm just not that person who wants to immerse himself in all this darkness. But I guess maybe it's been good for me. Maybe it's helped me realize. Well, you know.
So you are teaching the class.
I am teaching the class.
Oh, good.
So I'm seeing
good
light and I'm seeing dark.
Well, yeah, and there is like this, my generation, I don't know about your generation, but my generation grew up hyper aware of the Holocaust.
Oh, okay.
Hyper aware.
Okay.
Like every single English class ever was like.
Was just bludgeoning you to death.
Let's read about the Holocaust. Okay. Every single history class, read about
the
Holocaust.
We didn't need that in school so much because there was, I looked it up. I was going to try to find the top 10 World War II movies according to the internet.
Yeah.
And I don't think such a list exists because instead what you find is the top 100 World War II movies. And then you sort of realize that there's probably been somewhere between, 20 and 100,000 World War II movies.
Yeah.
And they're still making them, and we're 80 years past the war.
Yeah.
And so, like, when I was a teenager, these things were coming out every week, like, all the time. And so, like, there really wasn't too much of a need, I think, to hit kids over the head with it in school because, every history class concluded with World War II.
Yeah.
It was constantly in the movie theaters.
Yeah.
It was on TV all the time. There was like always another special, another World War II movie. It was just, it was endless.
Do you think you can chalk that up to the fact that World War II was the last American war where our motives were
good?
I think
you could probably say the Cold War motives were good.
Yeah, you could. You know? But people would take issue with that today.
Yeah. <know? laughs> Okay, here's kind of what I think. I think World War II is just a big story. and it's compressed into about 6 years from 1939 to 1945, if you're talking about the European side of things.
Yeah.
It doesn't drag on forever like the Cold War, which goes for like 45 years or so.
Yeah.
It also has a clean ending. Like, yes. You could look at World War One, and you could say, what's it all about in the first place? And then people are like, hell if I know.
Yeah.
And then after that, they'd say, well, how did it end? And then you would say, oh, inconclusively.
Yeah.
It sort of set everything up for World War Two, which happened, you know, 20 years later.
Yeah.
So, you know, I remember when I started teaching American history, I had to ask myself, what is World War One even for? Like, what was it about? What was the point? I remember the Archduke getting shot.
Yeah.
But then at the end of the war, I remember, you know, the winners deciding, well, let's get super vindictive toward the loser and let's just punish the hell out of the loser. And then the loser got embittered, and then that led to World War II.
Yeah.
So it was kind of like, hey, maybe at the end of the basketball game, we should shake hands and say good game and not punch the other guy in the face and hit him with a big war reparation.
Yeah.
You know, and so, you know, World War One, then the textbook said, well, okay, they fought it for four reasons: nationalism, militarism, imperialism, and secret alliances. Mm. And then I thought, well, that's really just one reason.
Yeah.
The one reason is we don't like you, so we're going to start a war with you.
Right.
Then you look at, you know, the thing that kicked it off, which was the assassination of this Duke, Franz Ferdinand, and his wife, Sophie. Well, okay, that whole thing maybe could have been treated as a crime. Like, okay, somebody got assassinated. That's bad.
Yeah.
But maybe we don't need to launch a continent-wide war that drags on for 4 years and kills all these people. Maybe it should have been treated as a crime. So I guess what I'm trying to say is, if you try to figure out, like, what caused it in the first place and who's the main person who's causing it,
yeah,
this is very hard for, I think, a modern person to know. I think if you went and talked to the average intelligent person and asked them a lot of these questions, I'm not sure that people would know the answer. Either that or I'm just colossally ignorant. What do you think? I mean, if I asked you about World War One, what would you say?
I would just say that it was a thing that happened.
Yeah.
Just like there were lots of things that happened.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But World War II is kind of the...
black and white.
The black and
Hitler
white.
Hitler is pure evil.
It was pure evil.
And everybody else was opposing Hitler.
Probably.
And so they were mostly on the side of the good.
Yeah.
Although Stalin's a pretty bad guy.
Yeah.
But Churchill said, hey, but if Hitler invaded hell, I would make a deal with the devil.
Yeah.
And that was his justification for working with Stalin.
Because lots of people think that Hitler was the devil incarnate.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I mean, if you ask the average person, name somebody who is pure evil, 100% evil, the average person is going to say Hitler.
It's always Hitler. And that's and
anytime we go to war with somebody new, then we say, well, he's another Hitler.
He's Hitler. Even Putin was using that as justification for invading Ukraine.
Ukraine.
Yeah.
Well, he said, yeah, we have to wipe out the Nazis in Ukraine.
Yeah.
Well, then it turned out that there actually are Nazis in Ukraine.
Yeah.
Which they're like the third generation of the original Ukrainian Nazis that were opposing the Soviet Union during World War II.
Yeah. Which go figure. But, I mean, I can't help but think that it's no coincidence that the education system being what it was when I was growing up didn't say a word about 200 million people dead under the Soviet regime.
Oh.
You know.
Oh, you mean 20 million.
Yeah, 20 million. Well,
20 to like 60.
200 million people collectively with communism. When you factor in China.
Right, the numbers are just really scary.
And Vietnam.
Really scary.
Cambodia.
Yeah, all over the place.
Yeah. South America. Yeah.
Yeah. There's one professor who called it democide, which basically means murder by government.
Yeah.
And he thinks the numbers are as high as 262 million people in the 20th century. Now, murder by government, that includes like the Nazis, the Soviets, lots of different communist countries, like some of the ones that you just mentioned.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think
it's very scary.
It's very frightening because I don't know. Okay, well, I understand that there is a sort of like moral question there in terms of, okay, well, if you're going to be a murderous dictator.
Okay.
Hypothetically.
If I'm going to be.
I would like.
I'm not going to be.
I would like to think that if I had to genocide people, I would genocide them for ideological reasons.
Okay.
And not for immutable characteristics that they can't change.
Okay.
Like being Jewish, okay, for example. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so I understand that argument from the perspective of, well, Stalin just killed his political dissonance. He didn't really care
about their race, religion.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
But why don't we talk about it?
Why don't we talk about Stalin?
Why don't we talk about Stalin? Why don't we talk about Mao?
I don't know. Why do you Pol Pot. Why did as by representative of Gen Z?
I don't know. I think Hitler is just too useful of an archetype.
Okay.
For us to take away from.
Okay.
You know? Because we need that contemporary example.
He's such a good dictator to hate, because if you look at some of these other dictators, Hitler is like ranting and raving, and people have seen these speeches where he's up and his arms are flying about and he's screaming into the microphone.
Yeah.
You know, and he's like terrifying, and he's got that mustache that nobody else has.
Yes.
You know, and he insists on parading around in a military uniform all the time.
Yeah. He killed Jews without any sort of when it was economically inefficient to do so.
Yeah, that's true.
He forewent a lot of the war effort just to kill innocent people.
He's really wasting resources that should have went toward the war.
Yeah.
I mean, he's a horrible person.
So it was almost like the extermination of the Jewish people was
more important than winning the war.
Yeah, and everyone's like, he was bent on world domination, but was he, you know?
You know, maybe. As far as, you know, I mean, we have some indication of what his plans were, and I think he believed that there was going to be ultimately like a final battle between super states, but it was probably going to take like 25 or 50 years before we ever got there. I think the initial plan was, you know, to conquer Europe and then to take a bunch of the eastern territory, like the, you know, parts of Ukraine and Russia.
Yeah.
He really hated Slavic people. He had a long list of people that he hated.
Yeah, he hated a lot of people.
Kind of starts with Jews, communists are in there, but then also to, you know, certain capitalists, and then really hates like Slavic people, and had like this whole racial science, and it's very ugly.
It's very terrible.
Thing's very ugly. Now the Soviet thing, I mean, that should have been taught and discussed in a very big way. I remember as a kid growing up, people really didn't like the Soviet Union, hated the Soviet Union, were scared of it. But at the same time, this is a little weird, but people were very cautious about how they talked about it. And I don't know if that filtered down from the leaders to the rest of the population, because the leaders tended to be very cautious about how they talked about it, because anything that happened in the Cold War was always called a provocation.
Yeah.
You know, like if we did something that the Russians didn't like, or the Soviets, excuse me, they would say that's a provocation. And then we would probably try to figure out a way to back off. And then likewise, if they did something we didn't like, we would say that's a provocation.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, and that's what happens when their side had 40,000 nuclear bombs in the 1970s and we had 22,000 nuclear bombs.
Yeah.
And I think it would take about one nuclear bomb to really change life on Earth a lot.
Yeah.
You know, because I just think about September 11th, 2001, where 3,000 people were murdered.
Mm-hmm.
And that cost the economy something like $1 trillion instantly. Mm-hmm. And it just kicked off all kinds of wars all across the world, in Afghanistan and Iraq and greater war on terror.
Right.
And just a whole decade of just people being anxious and being on edge. And that was bad, but that was 3,000 people getting killed.
Yeah.
I mean, can you imagine if a nuclear bomb went off anywhere and killed more than 3,000 people? I mean, it would probably kick off a world war.
Oh, well, yeah. The world would end. And I wanted to get your perspective on this with the bomb, because I had this thought
after I saw
Oppenheimer this summer.
Okay.
Do you know what a synecdoche is?
No.
It's a literary device.
Okay.
It's like a, I don't know. Think about this. Like the classic example is if the New York Yankees win a baseball game, we say New York won the game.
Yeah.
So in that case, New York is a synecdoche for the Yankees. So it's a piece that represents a hole or a hole that represents a piece.
Okay, I gotcha.
And it works both ways.
Okay.
New York won the game. Synecdoche. I think in a really abstract way, the bomb is sort of a synecdoche for the 20th century.
How so?
Because
the 20th century represents the bomb and the bomb represents the 20th century?
Yeah.
I mean, it makes sense to me.
Because I think everything...
The bomb changed everything.
The bomb changed everything and everything, almost everything important that had ramifications for how we live today happened in the 20th century.
Yeah.
Nukes, birth control, Diet Coke.
I mean, it was the century of technology.
Yeah.
Just really making radical changes in people's lives.
Yeah. And I think it's the century where...
I also think it's the century of chemicals.
Yeah.
What I mean by that is, well, for example, just go to the grocery store. Aisles 1 through 16 really did not exist so much. You know, before the 20th century, people would go and, pretty much the perimeter of the grocery store would exist.
Yeah.
Fruits, vegetables, bread, milk, dairy, and meat. Yeah. Those things existed, but all these products, like on aisles 1 through 16, didn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
And so then suddenly there's a belief that, well, you know, if we just have enough chemicals or if we have enough preservatives in our lives, like we're going to have, you know, hair products, you know, that involve, you know, spraying things. And we're just going to eat a lot of chemicals. Like we're going to read the ingredients list on the Oreos and there's going to be like, tons of chemicals in there. There's going to be like yellow dye number 5, et cetera.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to the doctor and everything is going to be pills, and shots.
Yeah.
You know, and just, everything is going to be chemicals all the time. We're going to live in this very artificial world, which is based in chemistry.
Well, and it's also going to be an extension of that would be it's the age of science.
Yeah.
TM trademark.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Capital S,
uh-huh.
You know, it's the age of science. It's the age of materialism.
Right.
It's the age of it's Freud just sort of prophesied this.
He did.
I think so.
What did he say?
I think Freud and Nietzsche both.
Okay. What did they say?
They're not responsible for. I shouldn't say that, but I think Freud made a lot of things material.
Okay.
You know. I'm
so confused. You keep going with this because I'm formulating a counter thought, but I want to hear what you have to say.
I just think that Freud was the one. Well, he invented psychotherapy for one thing.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and
psychoanalysis, like deep analysis, like assuming that there's so much more to you than what's on the surface that. You know, your conscious thought is maybe about 10%.
Yeah.
And then 90% of your personality is unknown to you, kind of like the iceberg theory.
Yeah.
There's just so much about you that's underwater.
Yes.
You know?
But I don't blame him for this.
Uh-huh.
But I think that he was really the one to develop the idea that if you're suffering or if you're burdened by difficult emotions... Something has gone wrong with you physically.
Okay.
Like there's something wrong with your brain.
Mm.
There's something wrong with your psychosomatic function.
Okay.
And the saving grace of the 20th century, in my opinion, is the work of a lot of these existentialists, some of which are atheists, you know.
Like a Jean-Paul Sartre?
I kind of hate him.
Okay.
He sucks. The guy you're attracted to when you're a young, up-and-coming intellectual.
Okay.
When you're 15, 16, is Albert Camus.
Okay.
You know, you read The Stranger.
Yeah, I wrote The Stranger.
And you're like, yeah. So, but thank God for Camus and these other existentialists.
Okay, first of all, for help people out, what is existentialism and why is it a saving grace?
For me, in the way I'm interpreting things, I think existentialism brought back the idea that if you're suffering or if you're upset or if life is hard, that's just how it is.
Okay.
That's how the world is.
Okay.
And I think it actually helped a lot of people maintain a belief in God or a religious belief.
Okay. That'd be kind of an ironic twist because some of the existentialists were atheists.
Yeah, it's very ironic. But especially coming off of the Holocaust and the bomb, it's like...
Because I think historically, correct me if I'm wrong, it's been a while since I've studied this, but existentialism is really kind of the belief that your life is up to you. And it's coming out of World War II. And so Europe had just finished burning itself to the ground and just everything was destroyed. And people said Europe is the cradle of civilization.
Yeah.
And if Europe is so great and wonderful, and if it's the best that human beings have achieved, and they just decided, oh, let's have an epic world war and burn everything down and kill everybody.
Yeah.
If the best of humanity is doing this, then what hope is there for any of us?
Exactly.
So then the existentialist came along and said, okay, listen.
There's no inherent meaning.
All of our institutions let us down.
Yeah.
So you need to look at yourself in the mirror and you need to say, okay, this is who I am and this is what day of the week it is and it's all up to me.
Yeah.
You know, so like look at yourself and say, okay, it's the 14th of March or whatever the case may be. And whatever I did, I got myself to this point.
Yes.
And the rest of my life is 100% on my shoulders.
Yeah.
I can't blame my parents. I can't blame my society. I can't blame my religion. I can't blame my ideology or my government. I have to blame myself.
Yeah.
You know, and so to me, that's my understanding of existentialism is it puts all of the responsibility, 100% of the responsibility back on me.
Yeah.
And then also on you. But I can't worry about you in that sense. I have to worry about myself first. I have to really understand that it's all on my shoulders.
Yeah. Well, and
that's my understanding.
That's why Camus distanced himself from... He never considered himself an existentialist. That's a label that gets put on him. He considered himself, he developed the theory of the absurd in a philosophical sense, which is like, okay, the world is supposed to be this way, but it's very obviously not.
Like it's supposed to be like this beautiful idealistic place?
It's supposed to be a, there's just so many things that happen in your life that don't follow the prescribed pattern of cause and effect.
Okay.
You know, Camus would say like, okay, you have this really good friend and he ends up committing suicide randomly and you saw no warning signs.
Okay.
He didn't leave a note. You don't know what caused this.
Right.
And all of your, there were no warning signs whatsoever and he just dies. And Camus would say that is the absurd at work. That is the world not following a quantifiable pattern.
Okay.
Because you come off the heels of the Enlightenment and it's like, oh, yes, we're really getting close to figuring out this clockwork that we call the universe.
You know? Everything is supposed to operate in a rational way with cause and effect, and things are supposed to make sense. And if we just do enough science, we can figure everything out.
We can figure everything out. We can come to that God particle. Like we can figure out what started it all and we can figure out how we can get into the middle of the machine. But what Camus was saying is philosophically we can never get there.
Right. Well, and again, isn't he also coming off of World War II?
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, just saying like, okay, well, we created this brilliant society in Europe, which then committed suicide.
Yeah. And Camus was actually really interested in suicide because he has a famous quote like, really when you get up in the morning, the question should be, do I have a cup of coffee or do I kill myself?
Wow.
Because
why was he this?
Because
very negative.
He thought, and I might agree with him, I don't know, but he thought that everyone had sufficient justification to commit suicide.
This is rough.
Because life is hard.
Okay.
And it is, and it is absurd. There's things that happen and you don't know why and they suck.
Well, and I think coming off of World War II, it would be very easy for people to just say, wow, everything let us down. Like all of our institutions let us down. Our culture let us down.
Yeah.
Our nation let us down.
Yeah.
Because there's really no rational reason we have to have a world war.
Yeah. And he's seeing all that. He was a Frenchman. He grew up in Algiers.
Okay.
In, French occupied Algeria.
Yes.
So he kind of saw the greatness of a great European empire mm-hmm. be absolutely squandered in World War II, and he fled yes. all around Europe.
There was a lot of that happened. You could make the same argument about Britain, right?
Yeah.
That they had this humongous empire that had conquered something like 22% of all the land on Earth.
Yeah.
And they just blew it.
And they went down to an island the size of Michigan.
Yeah.
But
well, fortunately, we don't live in a huge empire that's squandering.
No,
anything.
No. We don't have occupations in foreign lands for no
reason.
We're not
like running up a colossal unpayable debt
to another foreign power. But no, and Camus said, to his credit, I wouldn't recommend him as a theological authority, but I'd recommend him for someone who needs inspiration. He said, where there's no hope, we must invent it.
Okay.
You know, because for him, the central question was, look, it's patently obvious this world doesn't make any sense. And, you know, a rational person might be tempted to kill yourself, but he thought it was very dishonorable to do so, because if the default of living is to kill yourself, then obviously there'd be no, if everyone was inclined to kill themselves, then there'd be no reason for us to be living. So he thought there's something else other than killing yourself.
Okay.
That
does he get to the point where he thinks, well, there are so many aspects of life and people that is beautiful and inspirational.
Yeah. Yeah. He was distrustful of organized religion because he thought that what organized religion tended to do was to trivialize the absurd in life and just to say, well,
by dismissing it
and saying, well, we have to look past that. Never mind the Holocaust, never mind the bomb. This is still good. This is still true.
Okay.
And he didn't like that. So he thought he termed that as committing philosophical suicide.
Oh.
Because you're not acknowledging the truth of the world that life is suffering.
Okay.
You know. And I just don't think he properly integrated traditional Christian teaching with what he was doing.
Well, one thing that I always really liked about existentialism was basically kind of what I outlined before. It's as if somebody grabs you by the collars, shoves you up against a wall, and says, what are you going to do with your life?
Yeah.
You know, and it's on your shoulders. And stop blaming other people. And even if you live in a hellhole, what are you going to do with your life?
Yeah.
And I just liked that because I thought, well, if the opposite is true, like let's say I'm a victim and I'm helpless, to me that's totally demoralizing.
Yeah.
So, but instead if you say, hey, you still have some choices, you still have some options.
Yeah.
You know, even if you live in a hellhole, you can choose your response. Mm-hmm. You know, I just always thought, hey, that's an optimistic philosophy. And then of course I read that, well, then there were Christian existentialists too.
Yes.
They would choose Christianity. Their point was, you're still forced to make this choice. You still have to make this choice between atheism and belief.
Yeah.
It's still on your shoulders. You can't just say, oh, well, I'm forced into this one way or the other, because you're not.
And that's where you go. That's where you go from the existentialist to like someone like Soren Kierkegaard.
Okay.
You know, that's where you say.
I don't know much about Kierkegaard. Isn't he a Christian something?
He's a Christian. He invented Christian existentialism.
Okay.
And he lived 200 years before Camus.
Okay.
But it's so interesting because he's the logical extension of Camus.
Oh, that's funny.
Because you read Camus and you think, okay, well, I don't want to, obviously if the default is to kill myself.
Uh-huh. You're kind of rolling your eyes.
You're like, well, okay, there must be some other reason why I'm living.
Yes.
Because the world cannot be just a death machine.
Right.
It can't be strictly that.
Right. Although after World War II, I could see where a bunch of people would think that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, and then for the reward for going to all that effort to defeat, you know, bad forces in World War II, for the reward, then we get the atomic bomb.
Yeah.
And then we get the specter of the apocalypse for 45 years. So I could sort of see their point that life kind of is suffering.
Life is suffering, and it's absurd as in it's unknowable. But what Kierkegaard said was, he said, look, at the end of the day, okay, the Thomistic tradition of Thomas Aquinas would say, you can rationalize your way into a belief in God,
okay,
independent of theological framework.
You know, I've heard that, and okay, let me see if I understand this. People are saying, well, if you just use logic, that, you're going to arrive at a belief in God.
That was the late medieval, early modern understanding of philosophy at that point.
Okay.
Was, so you had Aquinas coming at it from one way, kind of the Aristotle way. They always say that Aquinas was trying to baptize Aristotle.
Okay.
He's taking Aristotle's great works and saying, okay, this pagan had it all right.
Okay. Okay.
Basically.
Yeah.
And putting it into a Christian framework and saying, like, look, obviously there's a lot of things that take the ascent of faith,
okay,
to be able to hold, you know. Okay. There's a lot of things. Like, you can't just rationalize your way into saying, look, Jesus rose from the dead, mm-hmm, 2,000 years ago.
Okay.
His body was physically resurrected. That takes faith.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But,
well, because, yeah, we're saying that a man rose from the dead.
Yeah. That's not something that you can just convince someone
of. Same logic. Okay.
Rationally. Yeah, but Aquinas would argue, well, look, he had like five proofs of God. He said, look at all these five ways you can logically,
okay,
without a belief.
Okay, give me one.
Well, the unmoved mover is the most common one.
Okay, which is what?
It's the idea that, everything has a cause and effect.
Okay.
You know, if I move this cup over, I was the cause of moving that cup.
Right.
And what's the cause of me being in this room?
Like, why is there, because your parents got together.
Yeah. And how did they come to exist? And it's just,
they had parents, and those parents had parents.
It would seem that it's an infinite regress,
yeah,
but
yeah,
the thing that we know about this world is that it's impermanent. So there's nothing infinite about it.
Right.
You know, scientifically,
yeah,
materialistically.
Yeah, the world's going to come to an end. I think the sun is going to be around for another, I can't remember, 4 to 8 billion years. And
yeah,
then after that, our planet's probably going to get consumed in a fireball from our sun when it turns into a red giant. So
yeah,
nothing is permanent here.
Nothing is permanent.
We're
so
going to get turned into atoms.
If nothing is permanent in the future, then therefore nothing was permanent in the past.
Right.
So
right,
something right, had to set the universe
yeah,
in motion.
Yeah, something had to get things started.
Yeah.
Okay, so
and you can
the
say
theory
it's the
is, well,
you can say it's the Big Bang,
uh-huh,
but then it's like.
But then what caused the Big Bang?
What caused the Big Bang?
So okay, so this unmovable mover theory basically says that, well, something had to be the original cause.
Yeah.
So why not God?
Why not God?
Okay.
And so.
Well, but okay, the counter argument could be like, let's just pretend I'm an atheist. I'm not. I'm a believer in God, and I think that life is better if I believe in God, and I think that life would lead to despair if I don't believe in God.
Right.
I think for me, it's an emotional thing.
Yeah.
But also too, I feel like there's been events in my life which make me think God was looking out for me.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I feel like I have personal proofs.
Yeah.
You know, like nice little miracles feel like they've happened to me.
Yeah.
You know, so I believe in God.
Yeah.
Very strongly. But all this being said, let's say I were the atheist.
Yeah.
I would say, okay, so you're saying God is the first cause. I could just say instead, well, matter and energy can't be created or destroyed.
Yeah.
Matter gets turned into energy. Energy gets turned into matter. And maybe that was the first cause. Maybe there was always matter.
Yeah, there's
you're
actually.
You're saying there was always God. I'm saying there's always matter.
Yeah.
If I'm the atheist.
Yeah, you could say that. And there's actually interesting research about the it's called the Higgs boson particle.
I feel like I've heard
it. It's referred to as the God particle.
Okay.
It's I don't know how scientists would have come across this, but they discovered an atom that basically spontaneously appears.
Mm.
And we're just not sure what it comes out of.
Okay.
Like, we can't track the energy that created
it. Like where it came from.
Yeah, it just.
How do we know it's not like a tachyon or something, like one of those particles that supposedly travels through time?
I don't know. I don't know. I don't know, but
don't you have some tachyons back home?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
They're like in a drawer.
We all have them.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. So Aquinas would make all those arguments,
okay,
and And then you see that go through with, like, Descartes in the 17th century.
Yeah, he's the philosopher who said, I think, therefore I am. Like, he doubted everything, and then he decided, well, okay, I think, therefore I am. I can't doubt that I exist or that I'm thinking.
Yeah.
So then he basically kind of started with himself and said, well, I seem to be a fact.
Yeah.
So therefore, I can go from there and I can figure out some other facts.
Well, and then he tries to prove that God exists by kind of basically an argument Aquinas had already used, which was the ontological argument.
Okay. So ontology is a way of knowing, right?
Yeah. So he said that, well, okay, I know it's since my mind can be deceived.
Okay.
Like I see things that often are not.
Okay.
You know, that are not so.
Right. I mean, so, I wear glasses. I don't have 20/20 eyesight.
Yeah.
Even when I did, things would be blurry. Like if I were looking a mile down the road.
Yeah.
If the road were really flat.
Yeah. So you've been deceived of something.
Yeah.
You know.
I hear things that aren't necessarily totally accurate. You know. Yeah.
So that's proof. He would take that as proof that our minds are weak and limited.
Yes.
Right.
Add alcohol and then we're really screwed up.
And then we're really screwed up. He probably did. I don't know. It's a pretty whack theory. But and then he says if God is perfection, as the Christian framework would conceptualize it, then there has to be that thing needs to exist in order for me to be able to conceive of it with my imperfect mind. That's the argument.
Okay. That if I can imagine that things could be perfect.
Yeah.
Then that's all the proof we need.
The fact.
Because where did I get that idea from?
The fact that I have an idea of perfection, and you can see how it has roots.
Oh, no,
in
I like that Platonism. Because I always ask myself, where do creative ideas come from?
Yeah.
And I don't take credit for any of them. Like, let's say I have a good idea.
Yeah.
I always think, well, where did that come from? It just came out of the blue.
Yeah.
You know, and so it was just like a gift.
You actually see this with Saint Augustine, because he was kind of a Neoplatonist in his day by saying, like, okay, so Plato was right about this idea of the world of forms, like what I was talking about with songwriting, you know?
Yeah.
You know, Plato's idea of, like,
that these beautiful things exist, we sort of discover them.
There is a perfection of, like, how do we know what roundness is? Can we draw it out on a board?
I mean, we can draw a circle.
Can we draw?
But it's not perfect.
But we don't.
If we zoomed in,
we'd
see all the flaws.
We never have, we can't really create anything that's truly circular. You know, but we have this idea of what circular is.
Yeah.
You know, and so Augustine took that and tried to, like, baptize Plato by saying, well, that exists, but it exists in the mind of God because God is perfection itself. So everything, basically all of learning is just kind of using the light of Christ as the logos to kind of uncover the perfection that's in the mind of God. And Aquinas took issue with that, with Augustine, because he said, well, if God is one perfect mind, then it's indivisible. Like, we can't just take one thing out of it. We can't just go into God's mind and take out the idea of perfect circularness, you know, or perfection or goodness. So Aquinas was much more in the Aristotelian camp and said, no, the perfect forms of something exists in the thing itself. Like, this is a table right here. Mm-hmm. What is the table for? It's for putting things on and sitting at.
Okay.
So present in this table right now, as we perceive it, is the idea of the perfect table.
Okay.
Because it's modeling something.
Right.
You know.
Right. Like people, I don't know, they're looking for the perfect girlfriend.
Yeah.
Or maybe girls are looking for the perfect boyfriend.
Yeah.
So that we have this idea of what perfect is, but we've never actually met perfect.
No.
Okay.
No, but somehow we know.
Okay, so the fact that we believe that some things could be perfect, maybe, or we can envision perfect, that's also a proof of God.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, by this definition.
Okay, I mean, okay, here's my problem whenever somebody says we have proof of God.
I don't know if I agree with this, by the way, but...
Well, my problem always is this. What do we need faith for, then?
Yeah.
I thought faith was belief in things that you couldn't prove.
Well, if
I had proof, what the heck do I need faith for?
That's why you have to take it back to Kierkegaard. Okay, because
and then what's Kierkegaard say?
Kierkegaard says, all of this is nonsense. You know,
this is what I love about philosophy.
You can't rationalize.
No, you're full of crap.
He says, Thomas.
Let me say that in bigger words.
You're
full of excrement.
utter human excrement. Kierkegaard says, you can't rationalize your way into a belief in God.
Yeah.
You just can't do it. It takes, and he was a Christian, and he said, it takes what he calls a leap of faith.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's a leap of faith, and, you know, they always say, like, hey, faith is a gift. Like, if God gives you faith, then, hey, good for you. Then you've got this wonderful gift.
Yeah.
That makes sense to me.
Yeah, and it is the correct position. Because because Kierkegaard said, if God is perfect and we live in an imperfect world, which seems to be self-evidently true, then he's always going to be distant.
Yes.
Because if perfection was in this imperfect world in such a obvious way, then we would never be able to grasp him.
But God's also supposed to be your friend, and so he can snuggle up right next to you and be like a good daddy.
And it all that. But he says there's always going to be a gap by which the human mind has to jump to get to God.
Yes,
you know. So and then that makes more sense to me. Just more emotionally.
Yeah, you know, I'll tell you kind of where I'm at with my faith life. I'll just mention one or two quick things.
Yeah.
This ends part 3 of my series with Sam. For the 4th and final part, come back next week.